This Week in Palestine offers news from both a Palestinian perspective and a global perspective. The following hour may contain views that do not necessarily reflect those of WZBC, Boston College, or its Board of Trustees. You are listening to This Week in Palestine, Truth and Justice Radio. I want to take a moment to highlight an urgent call to action. The Standout to Stop the Killing takes place every Tuesday from 12 p.m. to 1 p.m. at the Zionist Consulate, 20 Park Plaza, Boston. Your presence makes a difference. Raise your voice. Stand for justice. Good morning. Good evening, wherever you may be. I'm Bethany Marks, your host, and I welcome you back to another episode of This Week in Palestine. Today, we turn our focus once more to Gaza and the West Bank, because while the world watches, the suffering does not stop. The headlines shift, but the reality remains unchanged. It is Sunday, June 15, 2025, and the question persists, when will outrage turn into action? Stay with us as we explore the unfolding events. Before we start our episode today, I want to take a minute and speak in honor of the brave activists of the Madeleine. To the courageous crew aboard the Madeleine, part of the Freedom Flotilla Coalition's mission to deliver humanitarian aid to Gaza. On Monday, you were intercepted and detained by Israeli forces, but your message resounds louder than ever. We stand with you soul and heart. Your bravery, your compassion, and your defiance in the face of injustice inspire us all. You are not alone. We honor your courage and your unwavering commitment to justice and human dignity. Activists aboard the Madeleine and their origins. Greta Thunberg, Swedish climate activist. Rima Hassan, French-Palestinian member of the European Parliament. Yasemin Akar, Germany. Baptiste André, France. Thiago Vila, Brazil. Omar Fayad, France. Journalist, Al Jazeera, Mubasher. Pascal Morieres, France. Yanis Memhamdi, France. Swabe Ordu, TRK. Sergio Toribio, Spain. Marco Van Rens, the Netherlands. Riva Viard, France. Your actions echo across continents. Your presence on that boat is a testament to a collective human conscience that refuses to be silent. We see you. We stand with you. Zionism is a nationalist movement that emerged in the late 19th century with the goal of establishing and supporting a Jewish homeland in the region historically known as Palestine, now largely corresponding to the modern state of Israel. The movement was driven by the desire to create a safe haven for Jewish people in response to widespread anti-Semitism and persecution in Europe. Theodor Herzl, often regarded as the father of modern Zionism, played a key role in organizing the movement and advocating for the establishment of a Jewish state. Zionism has evolved over time and includes various ideological strands, such as cultural, religious, and political Zionism. The movement has been both celebrated for creating a Jewish homeland and criticized for its impact on Palestinian communities, leading to ongoing debates and conflicts. Is being anti-Zionist the same as being anti-Semitic? Why are Zionists working so hard to conflate the two? What is the perspective of Jewish anti-Zionists on this issue? Do they align with the views of Jewish historian Zachary Foster, who specializes in the history of Palestine? Today, we'll explore these questions by listening to Kim Iverson's interview with historian Zachary Foster as we delve into the meaning of anti-Zionism.
Recently, Noah Tishby, who is an author and was Israel's former special envoy for combating anti-Semitism, wrote this on X. Let's just get this straight. Anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism is not just racism or hatred. It's a shape-shifting conspiracy theory, and every few generations, it changes into something different. Now people are literally saying, oh, we'll just get rid of Israel and everything will be fine. Her post did receive a couple of thousand likes, but one post ratioed her, meaning it received significantly more likes. And this was posted by Zachary Foster, a Jewish historian of Palestine. Now, Zach wrote, "Hi, Noah Tishby, I'm Jewish. Many of my closest friends are Jewish. I love them all. My whole family is Jewish. I love them all too. My community is Jewish. Love them all. I love Judaism. I host Shabbat dinners, celebrate Jewish holidays, sing Jewish prayers, study Torah and Talmud, and love Jewish culture, history, and expression. But I'm not a Zionist. Zionism was an ideology that said, let's create a Jewish state in a country that's 90% plus non-Jewish. That's why when Zionists bought land in Palestine from 1900s to 1948, they uprooted the people living on the land because they weren't Jewish. That's why when Zionists created cooperatives in Palestine in the 1910s, 1920s, and 1930s, they insisted on Hebrew labor, i.e. Jews only, no Arabs allowed. That's why in the 1930s, Zionists expelled Palestinian Arabs from working at Jewish companies and businesses. Think whites only, but with the Zionists, it was Jews only. That's why in 1948, Zionist militias ethnically cleansed 750,000 Palestinians from their homes. That's why from 1949 to 1946, Israeli forces shot and killed between 2,700 to 5,000 overwhelmingly unarmed Palestinians trying to return to their homes after the war because they were the wrong religion / ethnicity. And then he puts the source there, Benny Morris, Border Wars, page 416. The Zionists wanted to create a Jewish state with a Jewish majority, and there were simply way too many Palestinians that would have been incorporated into the borders of the new state. So they had to go. They had to be expelled. The ideology created the incentives. The incentives created the outcome, wrote Zach. Zach continued on in this post. It was very lengthy, but rather than read it to you, he's actually here with us now. Zachary Foster is a historian of Palestine, writes a newsletter on Palestine, and teaches courses on Zionism and the Israel-Palestine question at PalestineNexus.com. First of all, why do you think so many today think anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism? Where are they getting that, do you think?
They make the simple conclusion that Israel calls itself a Jewish state. Israel claims to represent Jews. Israel claims to act in the interests of the Jewish people. And so therefore, if you reject the founding ideology of that state of Israel, therefore you must hate Jews. You must have something against Jews. That's where it comes from.
Is there any merit to that, do you think?
I suppose if Jews got together and said, hey, let's create a Jewish state on Mars, or let's create a Jewish state in Antarctica or the North Pole, or maybe we create a man-made island, and therefore there aren't going to be any non-Jews in that state, I suppose that wouldn't be inherently problematic, although you'd have to figure out a way of making sure no non-Jews entered that state at any point. And you'd have to figure out a way of making sure none of the Jews that were in the state decided to convert to some other religion, right? Because the problem when you say this is a Jewish state that's going to serve Jewish interests, well, what about all the non-Jews, including all the non-Jews that were there before the state existed? What about them?
Yeah.
They're not part of the state. They're not part of the national interest of the country. What role do they play? What if they have more babies than the Jews do? Well, then they're a demographic threat. So they're a problem owing to their DNA. They don't have J-positive blood, so we have to figure out what to do with them. Put them in a ghetto? Push them out? Do we create policies that incentivize their migration from the country? Or do we just ethnically cleanse them outright? Right? There's any number of things you can do with them. But the fundamental problem with the Jewish state in a country of so many non-Jews, by the way, who were all there before the Jews showed up, is that they are going to automatically face discrimination.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, it would be like saying, I want a white nation, a white nationalist nation where it's just for whites. But I mean, it would work in theory if you found empty land and you could place it in empty land and then ensured that you protected your borders and no outsiders. You just wouldn't allow immigration of outsiders in. And I don't think I have a problem with that concept as a concept. I mean, I'm obviously certain groups, it's a little bit jarring and feels distasteful, but I don't, as a concept, I say, well, I mean, you control your borders, you decide who comes in and out. That's up to you, I suppose, if you want certain types of immigrants over other types of immigrants. But the problem specifically with Palestine and that region, the Holy Land, is that there were a lot of other people there when this concept came about. But of course, the reason for that land being picked, it wasn't just, you can't just select Mars, you can't just select Antarctica or Uganda. There was other places that were proposed, right? Uganda, there was Madagascar at one point, there was an oblast in Russia that was also selected. But this particular land, what was it about this particular land?
Well, as you correctly pointed out, there were proposals, not insignificant ones, including a proposal to establish a Jewish state in Argentina, By the way, in Theodore Herzl's book, The Jewish State, he proposes either Palestine or Argentina. He seems to be relatively indifferent. And then you have a very serious proposal to turn East Africa, British East Africa, into a Jewish state. And in fact, that proposal was voted on by the third Zionist Congress in the early 20th century. Was it 1902, 1903? And a large percentage, was it 30, 40% of the delegates voted in favor of establishing a Jewish state in British East Africa, because there were signs that the British were interested in doing that, that they were actually willing to promote Jewish emigration and promote Jewish land purchases in British East Africa. And for that reason, many of the, call them philanthropic Zionists, who wanted to secure Jewish safety, who believed in, you know, trying to establish some safe haven for Jews, they supported that because, hey, what, Jews can be safe anywhere in the world so long as they're in control of their own destiny. That was the theory. That was the thinking. But of course, the problem was that you couldn't actually convince Jews to move to East Africa, right? You couldn't convince Jews to move to Argentina. And that was for obvious historical and religious reasons. The Jewish tradition is obsessed with the Holy Land, right? It's a critical part of Jewish theology, Jewish eschatology at the end of days. Jews, just like Christians, believe Jews will gather in the land of Israel. So the Holy Land plays a critical role in Jewish prayer and Jewish theology and Jewish law even. And so for those reasons, you just couldn't convince anyone to move to Uganda or Argentina or Cyprus or wherever else.
Mm-hmm. So it was just easier to convince, especially the religious Jews, of let's go back to the Holy Land, our ancient land, because Theodor Herzl wasn't even religious.
Yeah, it wasn't out of religious reasons. These Zionists in Eastern Europe, who were the ones who actually packed up their bags and moved to Palestine in the first few decades of the Zionist movement, they were overwhelmingly secular. There were very few, if any, religious Jews. I mean, that's what led them to Zionism, right? Because they had, because the traditional Jewish authorities, the traditional religious authorities in the Jewish communities around Europe rejected Zionism, because Zionism is this movement telling you, you don't need to keep Shabbat, you don't need to keep kosher, you don't need to observe the commandments. In Jewish law, you just need to move to Palestine and start a Jewish collective, build Jewish a Jewish secular society based on some rejuvenation or revitalization of Hebrew culture. But again, these are things that have nothing to do with Jewish law. They have nothing to do with prayer. They have nothing to do with Jewish practice. They're unrelated to Judaism. So no, this is not about Jewish religious practice.
Right.
But again, there was this belief in nationalism. And so at the time, all of these European nations, the French, the Serbs, the Croats, the Hungarians, right, the Germans, the Italians, they're all talking about our establishing a glory in our ancient homeland, our nation's ancient homeland. So, of course, the Jews pick up that idea and say, well, where's our ancient homeland? Well, it's not Argentina. It's Palestine. Yeah, I mean, maybe that was part of it. Although, like I said, there was a great deal of hostility among religious Jews towards the secular Zionists. In fact, when they first moved to Palestine, the religious Jewish community in Palestine was actually hostile to their presence. Firstly, because they actually competed over philanthropic dollars, right? Because the Zionists are establishing these, the Zionist colonization association. And by the way, they use the word colonization association in the names of their associations because they saw themselves as a colonizing movement, right? That we're going to bring a prosperity and we're going to bring civilization to these backwards Arabs. I mean, that was the perspective. And that's why they called themselves. So there's actually a fierce competition between the two communities. Traditionally, the Jews that lived in the Holy Land in the 18th and the 19th century, they were for the most part religious Jews. They were pious Jews, and they were able to sustain themselves through donations that came from abroad. And then, of course, the Zionist community was exactly the same. They also relied on these donations from Jewish philanthropists in Europe as well. Primarily, the Rothschild family was by far the largest backer of the Zionist movement. They backstopped all of the Jewish colonies. They provided political and economic support to the Jewish community in Palestine. But again, the religious Jews competed for those same philanthropic dollars as the secular Zionists. So there was actually some amount of hostility. And in fact, in 1913, the religious Jewish community in Palestine established an organization called Agudat Israel. It was an anti-Zionist Jewish organization set up to oppose Zionist immigration to Palestine. And these were founded by the native religious Jews of Palestine. Again, because they saw these secular Jews as actually a threat to their community, and actually as a threat to the intercommunal harmony that existed between Jews and Muslims and Christians in Ottoman Palestine. If you'll recall, on the eve of Zionist immigration, there was no conflict between Jews and Arabs in Palestine. We have anecdotes in the literature. Wasif Jawhariya is a Palestinian musician. He writes a memoir. And in the memoir, he talks about going on picnics together. He's Muslim. And he goes on picnics together with Jews and Christians in the Palestinian Arab neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah, where you have a Jewish a tombstone there from the ancient scholar Shimon HaTzadik. And every twice a year, the Jews would go on picnics there. There would be celebrations, and they would be joined by Muslims and Christians. They celebrated Jews, celebrated Muslim holidays. They celebrated Ramadan with Muslims. Muslims and also celebrated. They dressed up on the Jewish holiday at Purim, right? They lived in the same neighborhoods. You have anecdotes, for example, where Jews and Muslims in one courtyard would gang up. This is in the old city of Jerusalem, in the Al-Wad neighborhood. They would gang up against Jews and Muslims in another courtyard in the old city of Jerusalem. The fault lines were not even Jew against Muslim, right? There were different neighborhoods that would gang up against other neighborhoods. So Zionism threatened that coexistence. And I mean, they were correct about it. The Zionist movement wasn't about integrating into Arab-Palestinian society. It wasn't about trying to build bridges with Muslims and Christians. No, it was about building an exclusively Jewish society in Palestine. Recall that it wasn't until 1961. We're talking 14 years after the establishment of the State of Israel, where the Jewish labor union, the Histadrut, even allowed Arabs to join the union. This was an exclusively Jewish society with an exclusively Jewish labor union, with an exclusively Jewish school system, with an exclusively a Jewish economy. All the cooperatives were Jews only. In fact, there were Arabs that joined those Jewish cooperatives in the 1910s and 20s. And then by the 1930s, they kicked them all out. They might make another analogy, by the way, which is that they see themselves in similar terms as the Israelis see themselves, precisely because they're both settler colonial movements. Now, maybe Americans don't even fully appreciate this or realize this, because the settler colonial project in the United States goes back to the 16th, 17th century. We're talking 400 or 500 years of colonization, of settler colonialism. Whereas in the case of Israel, we're only going back 140 years, let's say. But in fact, they're quite similar projects, right? In the United States, you have people fleeing persecution, leaving, you know, the pilgrims. We were persecuted in Europe. We are embarking on a new land, and we're going to create our own state, an exclusively white state. And the natives are a problem because they don't belong to our community, and they need to be removed. And they need to be uprooted. And obviously that was exactly the perspective taken by the Zionist settlers in Palestine. These natives are not part of our project. They belong to our community. We don't want to have anything to do with them, and they ultimately need to be removed because they're in the way. And then of course, to the extent that they pose a security threat, they need to be expelled and or, you know, killed. And so I think in many ways, actually, perhaps they don't even realize this, but one reason, I think subconsciously or consciously, why there's so much support for Israel is because they see Israelis doing something very similar to what was done in the United States.
Yeah. Since you're such a knowledgeable historian on all of this, I want to, the most common things I hear from my Jewish friends, from, you know, I had a nice chat with a woman, a Jewish woman recently, who started off with, you know, I feel terrible about all the children and the Palestinians being killed and whatnot. But, and then, you know, then it's like this big but shows up, and it's, but, and then here are all the reasons why they're the bad guys and they're just trying to harm us. I think the first thing that I would like you to kind of discuss is who does the land belong to from a historical perspective? Like, who are the people showing up? Is it really their land? Because that's what I think many believe.
Let's just analyze that premise that you just put out there. So the premise is that, well, Jews have always been there. Thus, Israel has a right to ethnically cleanse 750,000 Palestinians in 48. Well, Alawis have been in Syria for centuries upon centuries upon centuries. Does that give Bashar al-Assad the right to exterminate Sunni Muslims and torture them in Syria's torture dungeons? You know, Nayib Bukele, you know, in El Salvador, does Nayib Bukele have the right to, you know, round up tens of thousands of men and imprison them in El Salvador's torture dungeons because El Salvadorians have been in that country for centuries. I guess I just don't even understand the logic here. Does Recep Tayyip Erdogan have the right to demolish entire Kurdish cities in the south because Turks have been in the Anatolian Peninsula for 800 years? I mean, just the logic to me doesn't even make any sense. But to the question that you pose of like, who does the land belong to? I guess I'm of the view that pieces of real estate on planet Earth don't belong to groups of people. That's not how international law works. That's not how international humanitarian law works. We've sort of inherited this Westphalian political system, right? Where we have all these states and those states are recognized by other states. Now, what does that mean? Does it mean that Jews as a category have a right to Israel? Well, that's not what internet, no, that, of course not. The people who live in Israel, the people who live in Palestine, those people have a right to live there, right? International law is all about protecting civilians in war. And it's all about guaranteeing the rights of individuals, not states, individuals. States don't have any rights at all in international law. Individuals have rights. You know, states have obligations, but does any state have a right to exist in international law? No. If Israel went away tomorrow, if Germany went away tomorrow, if France decided to establish a political union with Spain and those two states became one, great. International law has no opinion about that. It doesn't care at all. International law does not care whether there's 10 states in the world or 500 million states in the world. It's completely irrelevant. International law does care about peoples. Peoples have rights to exist. You can't exterminate a group of people. Individuals have rights under international law. You cannot carry out crimes against individuals. But do states have inherent rights to pieces of territory? Well, you know, religious zealots believe that, but that's not how international humanitarian law works.
What about the claim that, and I totally hear what you're saying, and I agree with you, the whole idea that states have the right to exist. I've always been like, what do you mean by that? I mean, Czechoslovakia doesn't exist anymore. Austria-Hungary doesn't exist anymore. I mean, the land is obviously still there. It's not like the land disappeared and the people are still there, but they maybe have a different national identity now. They have a new title. They have a new country. They have a new flag. Like, okay, you know, that happens. But so I hear you on that. One of the big pushes that I hear, a pushback that I hear a lot, is about the Arab states expelling Jews. I don't know exactly what the reasoning is for bringing this up so much, to be honest, as a point of argument, like why somebody would say, but the Arabs expelled us, you know, back then, and then they kicked us all out and Jews had nowhere to go. And so we all had to go to Israel. And what do you want us to do about that? That, I guess that seems to be, I'm still honestly having a hard, maybe you can actually explain to me what the argument is there, but there is an argument that's used a lot that the Arab nations expelled all the Jews. I guess that's supposed to prove that Arabs hate Jews, and that's like, then therefore we're allowed to fight and kill the children of this group of Arabs because Arabs just inherently hate us. And here's an example of why, you know, this showcases they're hating us because they expelled us from other countries. I suppose is that the argument? Is that what they're trying to showcase by making that claim?
Well, it's the same argument they're making. Yeah, it's quite a similar argument to the argument they would make today when you saw the headline, just was it yesterday or the day before, we're seeing sectarian violence in Syria. There's Alawis being rounded up and executed. And so they'll say, how come no one's talking about the Alawis being executed in Syria? Because it's not. And so they would tell you, oh, there's so much Jew hatred in the world. The only country people are willing to criticize is Israel. Right. So it's part of this kind of whataboutism narrative. Oh, well, what about, well, what about, well, what about, well, what about? It's deflection and distraction is ultimately what it is, because ultimately, what does Israel and the Palestinians have anything to do with what how the Egyptian government treated its Jews? That's an issue you should take up with Egypt, and it's Egypt that should be held responsible for having effectively passed many laws discriminating against Jews in the aftermath of 48. And that's that you should take that up with Yemen, where there were pogroms in Yemen in 1947 and 48. What does that have to do with the Palestinians? The answer is nothing. It's just a whataboutism. How come you're criticizing Israel? Look at what's happening in the DRC. Look at what's happening. I mean, it's just a whataboutism to deflect and distract because Israel's supporters don't want you to talk about the crimes that Israel has committed. They want you to focus on Syria or the DRC or wherever else.
Right. So it's just really to show the argument is meant to showcase, people just hate Jews. And that's Jews are hated, and so that's why you're not paying attention to all of these other crimes being committed in the world. That's and look at the, what the Arabs did to us. They expelled us, and look at the Holocaust. Like, everybody just hates Jews. So that's kind of the argument, I suppose.
That's exactly right. I mean, look, what I would add to that is that, I mean, it's quite an insidious point because, you know, Jews, in comparison, Jews lived relatively well under Muslim rule in comparison to Christian rule over the past 500 years. No serious historian of Europe or the Middle East would disagree with that point. Jews fared much better under Ottoman rule and before that under Mamluk rule than they did in early modern Europe or 19th century Europe or Europe. I mean, no serious historian would disagree with that point. But then what happened? What happened? What went wrong, right? If for literally 500, 600, 700 years, on average, Muslims treated Jews better than Christians treated Jews. But what happened in 48? Why did all these Muslim majority countries in the Arab Middle East all of a sudden sort of, you know, shift gears and turn their backs to the Jews? Well, obviously we know what happened because you had a Zionist movement trying to establish a Jewish society in a country that was overwhelmingly non-Jewish. And in order to realize that dream, they ethnically cleansed 750,000 Palestinians from their homes, creating this spillover population of refugees in all these Arab countries that which had its own kind of cascading a series of problems in all of those countries, right? And they have integration problems, and now you have these impoverished refugees that want political rights and want to return, and they're carrying out cross-border raids from those Arab states, and this creates all these problems. So of course, those Arab states are going to be angry. Of course, they're going to be, of course, this is going to create a major shift in their treatment towards the Jews of the in their countries. And by the way, that's not because there's anything okay with that. No, there's nothing okay with that. Collective punishment against Jews living in Arab countries was not okay. But guess what? This is a universal human phenomenon. There's nothing different than what they did, than what the United States did to Japanese during World War II when we interned Japanese, or what happened to Asian Americans in China, in the United States after, you know, Donald Trump called it the China virus, and you saw this anti-Asian hate. Or by the way, after 9/11, when you saw all this Islamophobia, right? It's the same phenomenon. It's that a group that is associated with some kind of atrocity, or a group that is associated with some kind of, you know, terrible act, with other members of that group are going to face retribution. They're going to face blowback. That's universal in every time and in every place in human history.
Although this is the one instance I can think of, and maybe I'm wrong, but this is the only instance I can think of where it benefits the actual group as far as what the goal is. Right? The goal is we got to move all the Jews to Israel because we're trying to create a Jewish state. So it's actually beneficial for that, you know, for that goal. If there's suspicion towards Jews, if there's hatred towards the Jews, if there's this elevated, hey, get out of our country, that is beneficial to that actual movement. I don't know if I can think of another historical example of the group being hated on actually benefit. And I'm not saying obviously from an individual perspective, there's no benefit to suddenly your neighbors being very suspicious of you, not liking you, you having to leave your home, leave your belongings, leave your neighborhood, your friends, all of those things. That's obviously horrible for the individual. So I'm not saying the individual Jew benefits from this Jew hatred that's happening. I'm just saying as a group, I don't know of any other instance of the hatred that the world, you know, it benefiting that group. Am I phrasing that correctly? Are you understanding what I'm trying to convey?
Certainly. And in fact, not only did they benefit from it in the sense that as a Jewish state with a razor thin Jewish majority on the eve of 1948, they were desperate for more Jewish immigrants to Israel Palestine. That's why, by the way, between 1945 and 1948, you had tens of thousands of Jewish refugees from Europe wind up in Palestine. And by the way, many of them applied for exit visas to go back to Europe after the war, to see family members that they had been separated from, to try and reclaim lost property, and so on and so forth. And the Jewish agency in Israel, in Palestine, was very hostile to those Jews, and actually worked with the foreign consular services in Palestine at the time to prevent them from giving them exit visas. They were held as demographic hostages. Wow. Israel is not about, you know, saving Jews or ensuring Jewish prosperity or trying to, you know, make sure Jews are living their best lives. False. They were about holding Jews hostage. And then they did the same thing after 48. You recall in Iraq, for example, this is, you know, well known, but, you know, Avi Shlaim writes about this in his memoir. But there's quite compelling evidence to believe forces in Iraq allied with the Zionist movement in Palestine planted bombs in Jewish community centers and synagogues in Iraq, in Baghdad, to incentivize flight, to scare the Jews of Iraq into believing that their lives were at risk and that their community was in danger. And so then they all packed up and moved to Israel. Israel did something similar in the Levant affair in Egypt, where again, they're basically plotting these nefarious activities in Egypt to frighten Egyptian Jews. So it's a very nefarious thing that the Zionist community did, but they were thrilled by this. I mean, when yeah. Jews are attacked abroad, Zionists and Israel celebrate, because this is the whole story of Zionism. This is fuel to the fire of Zionism, right? Anti-Semitism fuels Zionism. By the way, that's the same reason why over the past year and a half, I've documented something like 6 or 7 manufactured incidents of anti-Semitism. These are incidents in the United States on college campuses, places like Yale and New Haven. On Columbia's campus, we saw this. There was another case at MIT in Boston, about a half dozen of these cases where there's Jews getting up in public, trying their best to manufacture anti-Semitism. But because there's apparently not enough actual anti-Semitism to fuel the fire of Zionism, so they need to manufacture it. I mean, this is, you know, the same thing happened in Amsterdam. We saw the Amsterdam pogrom, where, yeah. you know, Israeli hooligans screaming death to the Arabs, running around Amsterdam, trying to trigger a kind of a response.
Yeah, right. So it's the only time in history that I can see where it benefits to terrorize your own in order to get your own to behave there's actually many examples of that. There's many false flag examples, right? Even just with our own country, the United States, just trying to rile Americans up into behaving the way they want us to behave. So I think that's actually, there's many examples of this. Of this kind of behavior. There was even with just the hostages, there's another historian, an Israeli historian, Lee Mordecai, who says that he's been documenting the war in Gaza over the year and has now published his findings, or has been periodically publishing the findings on how Israel has never tried to really save the hostages in Gaza, but that was not at all their state goal. Their state goal was to continue the war so that they could achieve their end goal of taking the land. It wasn't about saving hostages at all. It was to achieve this bigger, greater goal. And the history of the movement has shown that they've done that over and over, terrorizing not just non-Jews, but also Jews, and like the Jewish hostages being held in Gaza. I mean, completely terrified and being terrorized by their own country because they're just used as political pawns for an endgame. I mean, it's crazy.
You couldn't be more right about that. I mean, we've known this since the very, very beginning of this war, of this genocidal war on Gaza, when in October 2023, Hamas already said, all for all. You want all your hostages back, empty out your torture dungeons, and you can have every single hostage alive back. Israel had no interest in releasing Palestinian prisoners. Israel, perhaps at the time, was of the belief that they could use force to release the prisoners of war as well as the hostages. And that turned out to be false. And we all knew that was false because, you know, from the beginning, Israel was not even willing to go into the tunnels. Go back to October, November 2023. The operations were never about rescuing hostages. Never. In fact, Israeli soldiers were given explicit orders, do not enter the tunnels, which is where at the time the hostages were believed to be held. We later found out that many of them were actually being held above ground. They were later taken into the tunnels after that June 2024 raid on the Nusayrat refugee camp, when Israel slaughtered 274 Palestinians in order to rescue 4 hostages and perhaps also kill a few hostages. At least that's what Hamas claimed, and we don't really have any reason to not believe them. They've been quite accurate in a lot of their reports. But in any case, it was believed that the hostages were underground in the tunnels. Israeli military commanders gave their soldiers orders, you're not allowed to go into the tunnels, out of fear that they would also get kidnapped or that they were booby-trapped.
Yeah.
So the goal, the operation in Gaza was never about rescuing the hostages. It was about the total and utter annihilation of Hamas and of the civilian government. Mm-hmm. The complete annihilation. We're talking tens of thousands of bureaucrats, you know, hospital workers, electricians, maintenance workers. Right? Hamas is a government. right? It has, you know, it has an energy, a ministry of energy. It has a ministry of transportation, right? It has a power plant that it manages, right? All these people, the electricians working at the power plant, the engineers working on repairing sewage pipes, they're all Hamas. Israel's goal is to slaughter them all. And the goal was to completely annihilate, you know, to make Gaza impossible to live in. And the footage coming out of Gaza obviously shows that that's undeniable. When you're talking about literally, I mean, it makes these apocalyptic movies, you know. So anyways, that was the goal. It was never about hostages. And in fact, if you look back at Israeli history, I think there's some underlying theme here, which is that in the name of Jewish safety, Zionist leaders have long been prepared to sacrifice Jewish life and to put Jews on the front lines. I mean, this was the whole point of Zionism, right? It was, we're trying to build a Jewish state, and we understand that the natives are not happy about that because they're not Jewish, so they're going to resist that. Every Zionist leader understood that. That's why the Zionists were building militias, because they understood the natives were not going to accept submission without a fight. So they were building militias. They understood that the Zionist project of establishing a Jewish state in Palestine would require the use of force. It would require putting Jewish lives at risk. And that's why in 1948, 1% of the Zionist community in Palestine perished during that war. 1%. Mm-hmm. So the equivalent would be today, you know, imagine 60,000 American Jews just being killed and being slaughtered in a war to protect American Jews. Can you imagine 60,000 American Jews being slaughtered? I mean, at no point in American Jewish history or Canadian Jewish history or Mexican Jewish history or French Jewish history, you know, at no point from 1947 to the present, perhaps with the exception of Argentina, has any Jewish community in the world ever faced that kind of mass death. It was very, very dangerous to be a Jew in Palestine. It was in 48. Then it was again throughout the 1950s when you had all these cross-border raids, when you expel 750,000 people from their homes, they're going to want to come back. And some of them may even pick up arms to fight back. So you're just setting yourself up for decades and decades and decades of war and death and destruction. And in the past 15 and a half months, how many Israeli Jews have died in Gaza? How many Israeli Jews have been maimed and wounded? I think the last estimate I saw was 15,000. What other Jewish community in the world has seen 15,000 Jews be maimed and limbless and have trauma for the rest of their lives? The answer is zero. The only country in the world that is endangering that many Jews at that scale and putting them in harm's way like that is the state of Israel, the most dangerous place in the world to be Jewish. Look, in my case, it was really just a curious person and just honestly wanted to study the history. I just got, because look, if you grow up in a Zionist community in the United States, I mean, if you grow up in a Jewish community in the United States, they're all Zionist, you know. Maybe now things may be starting to change a little bit, but certainly in you know, kids who, people of my generation, you know, growing up in the 90s and aughts, and you know, every Jewish community in the United States is Zionist, and you're taught. I mean, you're just inculcated with the history, right? Yeah, and I was just a curious person. I actually just wanted to know. I didn't start off with the perspective of, oh wow, I'm going to become this, you know, a historian of Palestine and, you know, champion Palestinian human rights. No, of course not. I was just curious. And it turns out the more you study about the history of Zionism, the more anti-Zionist you become. Because what you discover is that every Zionist leader from the 1890s going on down to the 1920s and 1930s and 1940s asked themselves the same question. Well, how do we establish a Jewish state in a country that's 70, 80, 90% non-Jewish? How do we do it? You tell me, Kim. What do we do? Well, we have to expel them. They all realized that. They hoped the Palestinians would leave voluntarily. But they realized they were unlikely to do that, and they would have to be expelled by force. They all realized it. And this was something that occurred to me even really before I really became an anti-Zionist. I mean, I published a paper on this in 2006. I was an undergraduate student at the University of Michigan. And I wrote, and I was just curious. I was trying to study the history of Zionism. Oh my God, all the people that I admired and looked up to, that, you know, Ben Gurion and, you know, Arthur Rupin and Chaim Weizmann and Moshe Sharet and all these, you know, Zionist heroes, Theodore Herzl, right? These were my heroes growing up. But they all supported ethnic cleansing? I mean, how can you come to that realization and still be a Zionist?
So as you've talked to the numerous other Jewish family members, friends of yours, acquaintances in your life, and you express and share all of this history, what is their reaction? Do they then say, Zach, you're right. Oh my God, we cannot support this. Or do they say, no, you're wrong. I'm still a Zionist.
Look, I think things are changing. I mean, the short answer to your question is no. They do not agree with me. They may even agree on the historical details, which are at this point not controversial. No one actually disputes the history. right? There's no debate about what happened in 48. There's no debate about what happened afterwards. They were expelled, and those who tried to return were shot and killed in their attempts to return. So no one debates that. In fact, it's Benny Morris, Israeli historian, who is genocidal and has said genocidal things. And in the early 2000s, basically said the problem with 48 was that we didn't finish the job. We should have expelled them all. And so he's pro-ethnic cleansing and has said things. He even called essentially for dropping a nuclear bomb on Gaza in the past year and a half. And he's the historian who documents the atrocities. He documents the ethnic cleansing. He documents the mass murder of Palestinians after 48 who tried returning. So again, this is not disputed history, but it's very hard for a person who's been raised on this belief that the only way to keep Jews safe is through a Jewish state. It's very, very hard for them to unlearn of that belief, because it's not a belief based on facts. It's a belief kind of based on some counterfactual vision of the future. In the future, we need to protect Jews. And therefore, I can predict the future. I know, as a Zionist, that the only way Jews will be safe in the future is if there's a Jewish state. So it's mythology. It's kind of almost religion. It's not based on an understanding of history or an analysis of Israeli human rights violations or the conclusions of every human rights organization in the world, right? It has nothing to do with these things. They actually don't even necessarily dispute the facts. Here's how I would describe it. Zionism... So the religion of American Jews is Zionism. It's not Judaism. You can be a very prominent member of the American Jewish community if you're a self-declared and an open atheist. You can be a proud leader of the Jewish community and eat bacon cheeseburgers on Yom Kippur. There's no Jewish law that cannot be violated. You know, you can proclaim that you worship idols. It doesn't actually. But there is one thing that does violate the religion of American Jews. And that is to say, Israel should be a state for all its citizens and not a state for the Jews. That is a violation of the religion of American Jews. There's a film about this. It's called Israelism, right? It's this belief that Israel is an object of worship, that we should devote our loyalties and our passions and our philanthropic dollars and our love and our support for this a state. It's a religion. It's not based on logic or facts. It's just based on this irrational belief that Jews will only be safe if there's a Jewish state in Israel.
So I don't understand why you would remain Jewish. I can understand why you'd want to practice Judaism if that's the religion you believe in. In which case, I think you'd have to take on a different name, like call yourself a Judaist or something, like adopt a different moniker, because Jewish has now become Zionism. And I don't know how you as a minority don't get to dictate the majority, unfortunately. And the majority are not with you. The majority believes something completely different. And they say, Zach, you are wrong. And so how can you still identify with the majority when the majority is now Jewishness is Zionism? And those of you who are not Zionists.
Judaism has seen many ideological movements over the course of the past 3,300 years, right? Judaism dates to the ancient world. We're talking about a religion that has survived the Greek Empire and the Roman Empire, and then it survived the Byzantine Empire, and then it survived the Muslim conquest, and then it survived the Ayyubid states of Salah ad-Din. It survived the Crusader conquest, and then it survived the Mamluk states and the Ottoman state, and it survived the British colonialism, and it will survive the state of Israel. Israel is a very fleeting moment in the history of in Jewish history. It came in 48, and I don't know if it'll last till 2028 or 2038 or 2048, but all states come and go. Israel has come and it will go. That's just the nature of the universe. States come and go. Religions are much more durable, much, much more durable. In 1933, about 1.5% of American Jews were Zionist. And in fact, the Jewish left in the United States actually ridiculed Zionists because they were part of the petty bourgeoisie, they or the capitalist class. They rejected their working class solidarity. And even today, there's a growing number of Jews that are becoming more and more hostile to Zionism. There was a poll taken in 2022, so this is actually before October 7th. About 30% of Jewish millennials call Israel an apartheid state. We have polling, and I think by now that would probably be more like 40 or 50%. We have polling coming out just in the past 6 months. 40% of American Jews describe what Israel's actions in Gaza is genocide. Mm-hmm. Zionism is You're correct to say that a majority of world Jewry are Zionists, but that may not be the case in 5 years. And I would actually be quite surprised if that was the case in 10 or 15 years. So this is a fluctuating ideology that has risen and has fallen. And yes, Zionism did experience a golden age for about, really from 1967 until I would say 2023. That was the golden age of Zionism. Before that, Israel was not, did not carry the same status among American Jews that it did after 67. And after 2023, Israel does not carry the same status among many, many American Jews as it did before. So again, I would dispute the point anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. That's something that's in flux. And again, just because 80%, 90% of world Jewry identify as Zionists, that doesn't have anything to do with Judaism. Because when you attack Zionism, you're attacking a political ideology. Judaism has nothing to say about politics. You could be a Jewish communist, you could be a Jewish socialist, you could be a Jewish Zionist, you could be a Jewish anti-Zionist, you could be a Jewish Democrat, a Jewish Republican. Judaism doesn't care what your politics are.
I really want to kind of get a couple more questions from you. What do you think the ultimate goal is? So we see people talking about the Greater Israel Project. What do you think the final goal is of Zionism? Do you see it expanding beyond just taking the West Bank and Gaza? Do you think the West Bank is next at all? Do you think, what do you think the end goal is?
Well, first of all, it's not that the West Bank is next. The West Bank, you could have said, is the West Bank going to be next 3 months ago? But over the past 2 months, the Israeli military has carried out the largest operation of forced depopulation, of ethnic cleansing, since 1967. The Israeli army has forcibly expelled something like 40,000 Palestinians from the refugee camps in the northern West Bank, from the Jenin refugee camp, from Tul Karem, from Tubas, as well as, which one am I forgetting, Nur al-Shams. The Nur al-Shams refugee camp has also been emptied. So you're talking about massive ethnic cleansing campaigns taking place in the West Bank over the past 2.5 months. So it's not that we don't have to ask ourselves, is the West Bank next? The West Bank was next, and now it's continuing. But as to the question of what's sort of the goal here, I mean, the reason why that's difficult to answer is because right now Israel has a prime minister who is absolutely obsessed with a forever war, right? So forever occupation of Lebanon, forever occupation of Syria, forever occupation of Gaza, forever occupation of the West Bank. And there are a lot of reasons for that. Perhaps the most important of which is that Bibi Netanyahu faces, I believe, now four charges. There was actually just a documentary released about this, so you can actually watch the interrogations of the Shin Bet interrogating him. He's under a criminal prosecution for accepting bribes, expensive cigars, expensive champagne. His wife loves very, very expensive champagne. We're talking, so you have these rich American Jewish billionaires bringing in, literally every visit to Israel, they would bring in suitcases full of expensive cigars and champagne. He's on trial for corruption as well, because he has basically accepted, in exchange for allowing an Israeli daily to continue to publish, it was kind of a quid pro quo. We'll grant you a newspaper to publish. We'll grant you a license to publish your newspaper if you are support the policies of the Israeli government. And he has a third, bribery, corruption, and breach of public trust. And now I believe that just recently there was a fourth charge that was added. So he's quite likely to go to prison. But Israel has a law that says that you cannot be imprisoned for a criminal prosecution case if you're the sitting prime minister, right? So how do you justify your continued rule? Well, there's a war. You gotta, it's so long as there's a forever war, Netanyahu has an excuse to remain in power. By the way, he's also afraid that the October 7th, you have all of these kind of commissions of inquiries. What went wrong on October 7th? How did this happen? How was there such a breakdown in the security services? And all of these commissions, again, with him in power, he has a way of finagling and managing and what information comes out, what doesn't, whether are they allowed to investigate, what are they not allowed to investigate, what recordings get deleted. He's in control of all that. And so he doesn't want because obviously what we already know to be true will eventually come out. And it already is kind of coming out slowly. But there was a mass Hannibal order issued on October 7th, obviously that he must have been fully aware of and must have given the order to issue. which is that Israeli forces, Israeli Apache helicopters, Israeli tanks, went around the kibbutzim, Be'eri, Nachal Oz, etc. And then they were given the order shortly after the Hamas incursion, the Hamas invasion into Israel, kill anything entering Gaza. Anything moving on the border is destroyed. So we don't know whether or not they killed dozens of Israeli civilians or whether or not they killed hundreds of Israeli civilians on October 7th. And guess what? Israel does not want, Bibi Netanyahu does not want that information out. Mm-hmm. So he has many, many reasons to stay in power. So his goal is just stay in power forever. And so to the question of like greater Israel, well, is it Netanyahu's goal to kind of permanently occupy Lebanon and Syria? Yes, it is. Because that gives him the excuse to remain in power. Oh, we're fighting the terrorists in Lebanon. Only Bibi Netanyahu can keep Israel secure.
Yeah.
Are there other Israeli leaders who reject that kind of expansionist worldview? Yes, there are. So it's not that there's some essentialist version of Zionism that's always seeking to expand. No. There have been plenty of Zionist leaders who actually even said, why are we even in the West Bank? I mean, most of those Zionist leaders are long gone by now. I mean, the kind of Israeli left, or whatever is left of it today, is just shadow of its former self. You have these ex-prime ministers, people like Ehud Olmert, you know, even ex-Shin Bet leaders, people like Ami Ayalon, go on Zeteo and give interviews with Mehdi Hassan and say, you know, call Israel an apartheid state, right? And so you have this sort of these, you know, Israeli generals and Israeli former prime ministers who are in their 70s and 80s, they're octogenarians right now. Oh, the good old days when Israel was only sort of an apartheid state. The good old days before we were carrying out a genocide. Oh, when we were just a belligerent military occupier. So there is sort of this, there was this version of Zionism that, you know, the liberal Zionists, just like, you know, just controlling Palestinians in Israel and, you know, only kind of like occupation light, you know, with just only 500 checkpoints, not 1,000. Only ethnic cleansing once every 3 or 4 years rather than once every 3 or 4 weeks.
Yeah.
Right? But that version of those Zionist leaders are gone.
Since you are a historian, you've seen, you've been studying all the trends, you've seen what has happened in the past, what is happening now. What do you think is going to happen to the Palestinian people? What's your projection?
I wish I could be more optimistic on this one, but it's, I mean, the Palestinians of Gaza will continue to suffer for their indefinite future. There does not seem to be any will, not certainly not in the United States. Well, although I will say, we are seeing real pressure applied on the Netanyahu government from the Trump administration, something that Trump's predecessor, Biden, was not willing to do. We saw that with Witkoff during the first hostage deal, where it was very obvious that Witkoff told Netanyahu, you're going to make a deal because we say so, and that's it, that's final. And now you're seeing these Trump envoys, who went on CNN and said, we are not Israel's agent, or what was the exact quote? You're sorry. I mean, when did you ever see an American official say that? I mean, that I've never seen anything said like that before. I mean, this is a new era. So I'm not saying this is good for the Palestinians. We just saw Mahmoud Khalil, the Palestinian Syrian, a former Columbia grad student, be detained by ICE for having committed the crime of organizing protests against a genocide. So I'm not here to tell you that Trump is somehow some savior to the Palestinian people. On the contrary, he has given Israel green light to carry out some of the most horrific acts of ethnic cleansing and a forced population transfer in all of Israeli history. So this is no friend of the Palestinian people. I'm not optimistic for the people of Gaza. I'm not optimistic for the people, Palestinians of the West Bank. I'm not optimistic for the Palestinians living inside Israel who face extreme repression. I'm not optimistic for the Palestinians living in Lebanon or the Palestinians living abroad, like the United States, like we just saw. So it's more dark days to come for the Palestinian people, unfortunately.
I unfortunately agree with you. I think if history tells us anything, the Zionists will win because they have won many, many, many times over. More land, more gains, more death for the Palestinians. And part of me wonders if Trump just, you know, when he says, we're going to clear out Gaza and move all these people and we're going to take the land, we're going to develop it. You know, when he says these types of things, part of me just wonders if he's, you know, for one, I really don't think he likes to see death. I think he is actually adverse to that, to war and death. I think he genuinely doesn't like that. But I think he just thinks, you know, okay, it's inevitable. I mean, Israel's going to win. So get out and save your lives. Like, let's just move you, save your lives, and Israel can have what they're going to have because they're going to take it anyway. And it's either now or later, and you can either be alive or dead to tell the story. I mean, it's part of me wonders if that's, and I understand the pragmatism of that thinking, actually, of just look, they're going to obliterate you. They're going to win. This is a maniacal state. They've shown you they're going to win. So do you love your children or not? You know, and that's, I hear that from a lot of Zionists. Why they love death more than they love their children. And they're almost using it as, I mean, they're not wrong when they say that, in a way they're not wrong in that what they're trying to convey is you should save your life and your children and get out. Right. But they're saying it in that way, like, get off of our land. But they're not wrong. I mean, part of me says, yeah, but I'm not saying it in a harsh, like, get off of your land way. I'm saying, but practically, if you're thinking about the life of your four-year-old, maybe it is better to just get out because they are going to win. I do not see the Palestinians winning this any state. I think Israel will win this battle in the end. And it's just live or die for the Palestinians, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, I think we could say the same about the Israelis. You know what? If only they loved their hostages more than they sought revenge and bloodlust for the Palestinians, right? We could have said the same thing. It turns out that in Israel and Palestine, there is many people who believe that resistance and who believe in liberation and are willing to fight and die for it. And you and I may not like that or may disagree with that, but there's nothing you or I can do about that. People, when they're humiliated for decades upon decades upon decades. And by the way, it was the humiliation, I think, in the course of Palestinian history that has been the thing driving Palestinians to resist. It's being subjugated and humiliated, and that's what drives Palestinians to resist. So I think it's better to just live and let live and move on? And okay, they want Gaza. Okay, great. I'll make a home in Germany or I'll make a home in Mexico. Great. I mean, you know, would that have been my perspective? Maybe, but that's not the Palestinian perspective. It has never been and probably never will be. And
well, for a lot of them, it has been because a lot of them have left. You know, a lot of them have left and decided to make a better life for their families, their children, even though they feel very devastated about what's happening there. There's a lot of American Palestinians who left. There's a lot in Germany. There's a lot, you know, in a bunch of different places. And they did make that choice. But to get the whole group to make that choice is a different, you know, that's very, very difficult. And of course, it would, you know, the issue with it is it hands the win to the Zionists. It just gives them the win. Like, okay, well, I'll just leave because you're going to murder us. It's either I die or, you know, I stay and I die or I leave and I live. And you win either way.
Yeah, look, I mean, historically, Palestinians have been an agricultural people, right? On the eve of Zionist immigration, 80% of Palestine was farmers. Even to this day, a huge percentage of Palestinians formerly in Gaza, but still to this day in the West Bank, survive off of their livelihoods are tied to the land. They till the soil, you know, the olive groves. And Palestinians are farmers to this day, right? They grow their own. I mean, Palestine's a very fertile land. And I think ultimately when you're asking someone to give up their means of livelihood, you know, there will always be resistance. I mean, when you strip someone of their means to subsist, that will always produce resistance. And that's what we're seeing.
Zach, thank you so much for being on the show tonight and giving us your perspective. I mean, you're just great. You're a plethora of knowledge. I definitely encourage everybody to follow you on X. I do have that link down below. Is there another way for people to follow your work?
Yeah, so I have a newsletter. You can subscribe to that newsletter at palestinenexus.com. Every week or most weeks, we publish an article. I'm trying to provide historical context for the present moment.
That's excellent. Well, we'll put that link down below, palestinenexus.com. That is down there. That as well as your X profile are there. So that is how people can follow you, sign up for the newsletter. Definitely encourage it. You are just a wealth of information. Thank you so much, Zach, for being on the show. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
This was just a clip from the full Kim Iverson Show, which is Monday through Friday, 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern. Head to KimIversonShow.com to catch the full thing. See you there.
That's all for today. Stay informed. Stay engaged. Until next time, this is your host, Bethany Marks, and you were listening to This Week in Palestine. If you have any questions or would like to support us in any way, please email me at twippodcasts@gmail.com. I would like to thank you for listening, and I would like to thank the team that is working behind the scene to make this show happen. Many thanks to Bob Funk, Stanley Robinson, Stephen Lowe, Sophia Rose Woolman, Tahani Abu Mosa, Dr. Rana Awad, Juliet Salome Olivier, Professor Anne Lucas, Mohammed Al-Kul, and Lesh. This Week in Palestine is a production of Truth and Justice Radio, currently at the home of WZBC Student Radio at Boston College. As always, we thank you for spending your time with us today as we continue to work towards Palestinian liberation. See you next week.